to ourselves, putting what faith we can muster in our own minds and bodies. He quoted one of his acolytes as saying that, "Running gives me a sense of controlling my own life, and I would say the same of working out. I may not be able to do much about grievous injustice in the world, at least not by myself or in very short order, but I can decide to increase the weight on the leg press machine by 20 pounds and achieve that within a few weeks. The gym, which once looked so alien and forbidding to me, became one of the few sites where I could reliably exert control." To men of the left, like Lash and Studs Terkel, who also piled on, fitness culture may have looked like a retreat. But for women, control over one's body could be understood as a serious political goal. While you did not have to be a feminist to take up physical fitness, most women pouring into gyms had been through the punishing culture of female dieting and thinness, with its purging and fasts. They knew that women were supposed to focus on shrinking their bodies and becoming, as near as possible, invisible. To Gloria Steinem, this was another instance of patriarchal control. We were meant to be not only small, but weak, and to flout this expectation was in itself a form of feminist activism. "Yes," she wrote, "we need progress everywhere, but an increase in our physical strength could have more impact on the everyday lives of most women than the occasional role model in the boardroom or in the White House." Actor and activist Jane Fonda took up the challenge. She had been a victim of the misogynist thinness culture since the age of 12, maintaining her startlingly lean body by self-induced vomiting up to 20 times a day. At some point in the 1980s, she realized she was in danger of destroying her esophagus with these constant acid rinses, later saying, "I had a career, I was winning awards, I was supporting nonprofits, I had a family. I had to make a choice, I live or I die." Her recovery hinged on a new zeal for physical exercise in the form of aerobic dancing, which she took to marketing through the then cutting-edge technology of videos. Millions of women danced along with her videos, reassured by the glamorous Fonda that they could be both sexy and strong. And clearly, women had to be strong, since few families could hope to achieve middle-class status, marked by home ownership and private schools for the kids, without two working parents. The old financially dependent stay-at-home mom was going out of style, although ironically, she had far more time for exercise than her counterparts in the workforce. But if women are in a way masculinized by the fitness culture, one might equally well say that men are feminized by it. Before the 1970s, only women were obsessed with their bodies, although in a morbid, anorectic way. But in the brightly lit gyms, where walls are typically lined by mirrors, both sexes are invited to inspect their body images for any unwanted bulges or loose bits of flesh, and plan their workouts accordingly. Gay men flocked to the gyms, creating a highly chiseled standard of male beauty. The big change, though, was that heterosexual men were also objectified by the fitness culture, encouraged to see themselves as the objects of other people's appreciation, or, as the case may be, scorn. For both sexes in the endangered white-collar middle class, the body became an essential element of self-presentation, not just its size and general shape, but the squareness of shoulders, the flatness of tummy, and when sleeves were rolled up, the carefully sculpted contours of muscle. Fitness, or the efforts to achieve it, quickly took on another function for the middle class, as an identifying signal or class cue. Unfit behavior like smoking or reclining in front of the TV with a beer signified lower class status, while a dedication to health, even if evidenced only by carrying a gym bag or yoga mat, advertised a loftier rank. Consider the matter of food choices. In the 1970s, foods seemed to sort themselves out along class lines, with the affluent opting for those deemed to be natural, organic, whole grain, or just whole, whatever a whole food is, and above all, pure. Intertwined between all these descriptors was the inescapable insistence on low fat. That whole grain bread was not to be buttered. Jane Brody, the New York Times health columnist, relentlessly promoted the low-fat way of life to the masses, producing columns from the 1980s on with headlines like, "Our excessive protein intake can hurt liver, kidneys, bone. Carbohydrates can help you lose weight." And, "Chemicals in food are less harmful than fat." Heeding her and other anti-fat fanatics like cardiologist Dean Ornish, Americans reduced their fat intake from 40% of calories ingested in 1970 to 34% in 2000, with the result, which makes sense retrospectively, that we had an obesity epidemic as people gave up fat for healthy treats like fat-free cookies. But the long crusade against dietary fat succeeded in establishing that fat is for economic losers, an association prefigured by the word grease, as in greaser or greasy spoon. Working out is another form of conspicuous consumption. Affluent people do it, and especially if muscular exertion is already part of their job, lower-class people tend to avoid it. There are exceptions like the working-class male bodybuilders, meatballs, who can be found in places like Gold's Gym, as well as the lower-class women who attempt to shed pounds at Curves, a descendant of the women's-only gym where I started my workout career. By and large, though, working out is a reliable indicator of social status. Author and sustainable living expert Wanda Urbanska reported a conversation overheard between two women at a California gym, in which one complains about a new boyfriend. "The only thing wrong with him is he will not work out. He flat out refuses." To which her friend replies, "So you're going to have to let him go." "Do I have a choice?" the first woman responds. The safest option for a single hoping to meet a partner who can pull his or her own weight is to restrict one's romantic interests to fellow health club members. There is something almost utopian about the social spaces created by the fitness culture. Forget about the people who don't have the money or the time to participate. Ignore the low-paid janitors, maintenance workers, and front desk clerks, whose jobs don't even offer health insurance. Just focus on the entitled inhabitants of the gym, or running or rowing group, who are encouraged to make themselves healthier and more attractive in a leisurely, carefully designed way, stopping for an occasional juice drink or chat. In this world, the sexes are more or less equal. People of all skin colors and sexual orientations mingle freely without the need to drink or dress up. Bodies are displayed with a minimum of self-consciousness. There's free Wi-Fi, and in the locker rooms, free shampoo and moisturizer. But stay around a little longer. 30 years of attending various gyms around the country, in my case, and the picture looks a little less idyllic. Despite the pulsing pop music and comfortable clothes, gyms are not sites of spontaneity and play. There are rules beamed out from video monitors, mostly innocuous ones, like no cursing, staring at others, or expressing effort in audible forms such as grunts or panting. Once in a Key West gym, which you might imagine to be a somewhat permissive environment, I saw the manager chastise a young woman for moving too freely and rhythmically. "No dancing in the gym," he announced, nonsensically, as if to underscore the seriousness of our undertaking. "A regimented dance-like experience, as in aerobics or Zumba, is fine, but unsupervised dance moves reek of hedonism, and working out is supposed to be a form of work. Most people come with a plan like legs and shoulders today, or 45 minutes of cardio and 15 minutes of abs, usually preceded by a warm-up and topped off with several minutes of stretching on a mat." Working out very much resembles work, or a curious blend of physical labor and office work. Members not only lift weights, for example, they often carry clipboards on which to record the number of reps and sets and the amount of weight lifted for each workout, like a supervisor monitoring a factory worker's performance. Even socializing is rare, if only because gym members are increasingly plugged into their iPods and can be alerted to an attempted communication, such as, "May I work in?" or "Are you done with this now?" only by frantic waving and gestures. The major interaction that goes on in gyms is not between members or between members and staff, but between the fitness devotee and his or her body. The body must be trained, disciplined, and put to ever more demanding tests, all administered and evaluated by the devotee's conscious mind. Compared to the mind, the body can be thought of as an animal, usually a domesticated or partially domesticated animal, capable of reflex and habit, though not, of course, conscious decision-making. The poet Delmore Schwartz described his body as a heavy bear, breathing at my side, that heavy animal, that heavy bear who sleeps with me. We learn from coaches and fitness class instructors that, like any other beast of burden, the body is always inclined to take the path of least resistance unless we can trick it with a sudden variation in the workout routine. Western philosophy has long separated body from mind. Fitness culture takes this dualism further, to an adversarial relationship in which mind struggles for control over the lazy, recalcitrant body. I plan to work out today, but I will not tell you exactly what I'll do lest my body find out. And why should the mind want to subdue the body systematically, repeatedly, day after day? Many gym-goers will tell you cheerfully that it makes them feel better, at least when the workout is over. But there's a darker, more menacing side to the preoccupation with fitness, and this is the widespread suspicion that if you can't control your own body, you're not fit in any sense to control anyone else, and in their work lives, that is a large part of what typical gym-goers do. We are talking here about a relative elite of people who are more likely to give orders than to take them, managers and professionals. In this class, there are steep penalties for being overweight or in any other way apparently unhealthy. Flabby people are less likely to be hired or promoted. They may even be reprimanded and obliged to undergo the company's wellness program, probably consisting of exercise, on or off-site, nutritional counseling to promote weight loss, and, if indicated, lessons in smoking cessation. Employee wellness is not a traditional concern of large capitalist enterprises, which are historically better known for imposing unhealthy conditions on their workers. Exposure to hazardous substances in the case of blue-collar workers, punishing workloads, and unholy levels of stress for workers of all colors. At some point in the 1970s and 80s, though, companies got the idea that promoting individual health might reduce their expenditures on employee health insurance, an insight that eventually led to what is now a $6 billion industry in creating and managing corporate wellness programs. Participation in these is not entirely optional. Some employers will raise workers' contributions to their health insurance by $500 or so, and then waive the price increase for employees who undergo a health assessment and submit to the follow-up regimen, typically involving weight loss goals. Many workers complain, at least to outside researchers, that corporate wellness programs are coercive and overly intrusive, just one more source of workplace-related stress. Promoters of corporate wellness programs claim that they reduce employer health insurance expenditures by a hefty percentage, but a massive 2014 study by the Rand Corporation found that they have little, if any, immediate effects on the amount employers spend on health care. It was the existence of widespread health insurance that turned fitness into a moral imperative. Insurance involves risk-sharing, with those in need of care being indirectly subsidized by those who are healthier, so that if you are sick or overweight, or just guilty of insufficient attention to personal wellness, you are a drag on your company, if not your nation. As the famed physician and Rockefeller Foundation president John H. Knowles put it in 1977, the cost of sloth, gluttony, alcoholic intemperance, reckless driving, sexual frenzy, and smoking is now a national and not an individual responsibility. One man's freedom in health is another man's shackle in taxes and insurance premiums. Or, in the words of former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare Joseph Califano, "We have met the enemy, and they are us." Never mind that poverty, race, and occupation play a huge role in determining one's health status. The doctrine of individual responsibility means that the less-than-fit person is a suitable source not only of revulsion, but resentment. The objection raised over and over to any proposed expansion of health insurance was, in so many words, "Why should I contribute to the care of those degenerates who choose to smoke and eat cheeseburgers?" The idea that we are each individually responsible for our own health is perhaps most significant for what it omits. Not only environmental and socioeconomic factors, but doctors and healthcare providers of all sorts who were by and large unprepared for the fitness revolution. A 2014 white paper from the Bipartisan Policy Center reported that 75% of U.S. physicians felt that their medical training in nutrition and exercise was insufficient for counseling patients with obesity-related problems. In fact, doctors and fitness gurus seem to occupy non-overlapping worlds. You will often find, stamped in small letters on fitness equipment, the advice that you not undertake a fitness program without first obtaining a physical examination. But of course, an exam is not required for gym membership, nor are you likely to find posters in gyms reminding you of the need for medical screenings. Similarly, doctors' offices do not, at least in my experience, offer literature or advice on exercise programs, nor do they encourage clients to be environmentally responsible. A doctor may inquire as to whether you exercise, but in most cases, he or she is satisfied with a simple yes. The exception is the rare celebrity doctor, like the scientifically discredited Dr. Oz, who ministers to millions of TV viewers at a time, offering a mix of nutritional and exercise tips, along with alternative and natural remedies such as aromatherapy and mud baths. Besides, the fitness movement's core ideology of self-improvement and self-responsibility tends to render physicians irrelevant. Why ask a possibly flaccid medical doctor for diet and exercise tips that you can readily find on TV or the internet? Why waste precious time sitting in a doctor's waiting room when you could be working out? Jerry Rubin credited yuppies, that being the identity he embraced after growing out of the yippies, with bringing about America's health revolution, explaining that yuppies don't wait to get sick and then let a doctor do the rest with pills and surgery. They work to avoid getting sick in the first place. From this has emerged the nation's new awareness of self-responsibility for fitness and nutrition. One way for the medical profession to maintain its grip in a world of increasingly do-it-yourself healthcare was to establish the doctor's office as a kind of way station along the patient's fitness journey, a place to check in periodically on one's blood pressure, cholesterol levels, and other markers of fitness success. And for years in the 1980s and 90s, fitness devotees were content with this arrangement, carefully managing their diets and exercise regimens, and reporting to the physician now and then for a pat on the back. But then, almost without warning, the job of monitoring people's health underwent a sudden burst of automation. There had always been a degree of self-monitoring, weighing oneself and, in the case of diabetics, checking blood sugar levels throughout the day. In the 21st century, technologies arose to enable continuous, convenient, unobtrusive self-monitoring of dozens of variables, including blood pressure, heart rate, calorie intake, number of steps taken in a day, even mood. Epileptics can wear devices that will warn them of oncoming seizures. Asthmatics can be alerted to incipient attacks. In 2014, Forbes reported that the market for devices was red hot, and indeed a year later that one-third of American consumers were using at least some kind of wearable health monitoring device. The medical profession was no more prepared for self-monitoring than it had been for the fitness revolution. Most frontline practitioners were still reeling from the challenge of electronic medical record keeping, and that only dealt with data a doctor could collect, not the potentially unlimited streams of data patients could now gather for themselves. One reaction was to denounce the self-monitoring devices as mere toys, not FDA-approved or accurate enough to base medical decision-making on. More churlishly, some doctors accused the devices of fostering hypochondria, as patients became obsessed with insignificant fluctuations in their biodata. When the health-obsessed computer scientist Ray Kurzweil first attempted to engage a physician in his ultra-detailed concerns, he was cut off by the doctor, who said, "Look, I just don't have time for this. I have patients who are dying that I have to attend to." Other physicians were more welcoming, most notably Eric Topol, the cardiologist, geneticist, and self-monitoring innovator who was declared one of the rock stars of science by GQ magazine in 2009. Declaring that the self-monitoring movement was the biggest shakeup in the history of medicine, he announced that the new role of the physician was to prescribe not drugs or surgery, but self-monitoring apps. "You name the condition, we get the apps to match up with your phone," he told the BBC. And physicians could still play a role in helping the patient interpret the volumes of unrelated data that his or her devices were collecting. Unless, of course, that function is also automated. Already, a swarm of new startups is developing aggregator platforms that will integrate the various data flowing in from wearable devices, potentially leaving the doctor almost entirely out of the loop. But for the average seeker of health and fitness, like myself, whose self-monitoring has probably not advanced beyond the Fitbit, which counts the number of steps you take each day, stage, it hardly matters whether physicians endorse or condemn the new technologies. We have our own goals and quotas to fulfill. Number of stairs to climb on the Stairmaster. Reps to perform with 10 or 20-pound weights. Minutes to travel on the inclined treadmill. And in these endeavors, we are far more likely to be influenced by fitness websites, personal trainers, and other gym-goers than by any sort of healthcare professional. In fact, in the ultimate concession to the DIY trend, growing numbers of physicians now employ nutrition and fitness coaches, who, like personal trainers and gyms, will patiently attend to the minutiae of one's self-care, leaving the doctor to scan the horizon for oncoming threats. It's tempting to invest one's daily workout with a kind of dwarfish heroism. It may look like I'm just doggedly repeating the same routine with slight variations from day to day, but the real drama lies in the invisible confrontation between mind and muscle, in which I am the only conscious participant. Can I increase the load on my quads, and by how much? Are the lats getting a little lazy, and what will it take to shake them up? In the course of my own fitness journey, I have gone from being an embarrassed weakling to something of a show-off, taking over a machine from a young, strong man and ostentatiously increasing the weight on it, preferably while he is still watching. At my zenith, I could draw spectators for my leg presses at 270 pounds and lunges while holding a 20-pound weight in each hand. None of this has had much effect on my daily life, other than to make me cackle contemptuously when a supermarket clerk asks if I need help getting my groceries to the car. Then, in just the last few years, I began to hit a wall. I developed temporarily disabling knee problems, which x-rays showed were attributable to overexertion rather than, as was to be expected at my age, arthritis. My lower back easily clenched into knots. I had to try to develop a less adversarial stance toward my body, or at least learn how to listen to it. I adjusted my routine accordingly and expanded my menu of stretches. The ideology of fitness, which had so far encouraged me to treat my body as a recalcitrant mass I was required to carry around with me everywhere, showed a softer side, emphasizing the wisdom of the body and the need to develop some sort of détente with it. For a moment, I even toyed with the idea of a yoga class, possibly including meditation, before deciding that I'm not quite old enough for that. If anything, the culture of fitness has grown more combative than when I first got involved. It is no longer enough to have a good workout, as the receptionist at the gym advises every day. You should crush your workout. Health and strength are tedious goals compared to my gym's new theme of explosive strength achieved, as far as I can see, through repeated whole-body swinging of a kettlebell. If your gym isn't sufficiently challenging, you might want to try an ultra-extreme warrior workout, or buy a home fitness system from P90X, which recently tweeted a poster of an ultra-cut male upper body, head bowed as if in prayer, with the caption, "A moment of silence, please, for my body has no idea what I'm about to put it through." Or you could join CrossFit, the fastest-growing type of gym in the world, and also allegedly the most physically punishing. We have sought to build a program that will best prepare trainees for any physical contingency, the company boasts, not only for the unknown, but for the unknowable. And the latter category includes the zombie apocalypse. The mind's struggle for mastery over the body has become a kind of mortal combat. The South African runner Oscar Pistorius, who is now serving a sentence for the 2013 murder of his girlfriend, had more to overcome than most athletes. His legs had been amputated below the knees when he was a toddler. But he managed to become both a Paralympic and Olympic champion. Tattooed on his back is a modified verse from Corinthians. "I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. I execute each stride with intent. I beat my body and make it my slave. I bring it under my complete subjection." Chapter 5. The Madness of Mindfulness. In the struggle between mind and body, perpetually reenacted by fitness seekers, the mind is almost universally conceived as the good guy, the moral overdog that must by all rights prevail. Contemporary fitness culture concedes a certain advisory status to the body. We should listen to it, since, after all, the body is capable of doing a great many important things on its own, from healing wounds to incubating fetuses, with no discernible instructions from the conscious mind. So if your hamstrings are squealing with pain, it may be time to recalibrate the leg lifts and squats. All-purpose guru Deepak Chopra advises, "Be open to your body. It's always speaking. Be willing to listen. Trust your body. Every cell is on your side, which means you have hundreds of billions of allies." It's up to you, of course, to tune in to the body or ignore it. As a health columnist puts it, "Your body pays attention to you. It thinks you're important. If you've spent a whole lot of time ignoring how you feel, just bulldozing along, your body has probably decided you're not interested in listening to these lines of communication. It hits the mute button. That's okay. You can turn your volume back on." The superiority of mind over body, or more majestically, spirit over matter, is inscribed in every post-pagan religion and philosophical system. In the Manichaean religion of 3rd century CE Mesopotamia, which drew on Christian Gnosticism as well as Buddhism, all of cosmology is a struggle between a good, spiritual world of light and an evil material world of darkness, a theme that came to full dark flower in the medieval Catholic Church with its celebration of self-mortification. Saints, for example, who dined on little more than the dust they found in their monastic cells. To achieve spiritual salvation, the spirit had to be freed from the body and all its vile inclinations, including its tendency toward disease and corruption. Today's Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, while far more permissive, often require adherence to some dietary rules and physical acts of obeisance like kneeling and prostration in prayer or wearing restrictive clothing. At the very least, the mind or spirit is expected to keep a tight rein on the body's slothful, gluttonous, and lustful impulses. A 20th century anorectic associated her wasted body with absolute purity, hyperintellectuality, and transcendence of the flesh, adding that, "My soul seemed to grow as my body waned." But can the mind be trusted? Surveying today's fitness culture, a mid-20th century psychiatrist would no doubt find reasons to suspect a variety of mental disorders: masochism, narcissism, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and homoerotic tendencies, which were viewed as pathological until the 1970s, any of which could indicate the need for professional intervention. Even the untrained eye can detect the occasional skeletal anorectic in the gym, sweating through hours of cardiovascular training, and start to question the assumed intellectual superiority of the mind. We have come, hesitantly, to respect the wisdom of the body, but can we be sure of the wisdom of the mind? Just within the last decade, a new reason for alarm has arisen. Not only may the mind be twisted by the traditional emotional disorders like depression, but its fundamental cognitive powers appear to be dwindling. Teachers, parents, and psychologists have noted a steep decline in the ability to pay attention among both children and adults. A 2015 study found that the average adult attention span had shrunk from 12 seconds a dozen years ago to 8 seconds, which is shorter than the attention span of a goldfish. Something seems to be going very wrong with the human mind, not in its emotional responses to the world, which have always been a bit unreliable, but in its ability to perceive and understand that world. Among the many diagnoses being bandied about are autism, which now occupies an entire spectrum of symptoms, Asperger's syndrome, attention deficit disorder, ADD, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, all of which overlap in symptomatology and can markedly affect academic performance. Any parent whose child was performing less than brilliantly in school would be remiss not to seek medical help. ADD and ADHD are now the most common pediatric diagnoses after asthma, partly for reasons that have nothing to do with any actual epidemiology. In the first decade of the 21st century, drug companies started marketing stimulants like Adderall and Ritalin as treatments for ADD, ADHD, often targeting parents and even children directly. One such ad showed a mother hugging a little boy who had gotten a B-plus on a test, captioned with, "Finally, schoolwork which matches his intelligence." Another showed a kid in a monster costume removing his monster head covering to reveal a smiling blonde boy. "There's a great kid in there," reads the text. "Now there's a new way to help him out." Whether the drugs worked or not to boost grades, affluent parents were discovering that a diagnosis of ADD-ADHD could warrant giving their child additional time to complete in-class tests, a small but possibly decisive advantage in the competition to get into a good high school or college. It did not take years of laboratory research to get to the likely source of this new epidemic. Parents could see what was happening to their own children, who were being drawn to electronic devices, cell phones, computers, and iPads, as if to opium-infused cupcakes. They stare at the small screens for hours a day, often switching moment by moment between games, videos, and texting their friends. They have trouble focusing on homework or anything else in the real world, even when their devices are forcibly removed. Neuroscientists confirmed that electronic addiction was rewiring the human brain, depleting attention span, and degrading the quality of sleep. In fact, as they withdrew from the physical world into their texts and their tweets, adults could see the same things happening to themselves. The term distracted parenting was invented to describe the parent who could barely focus on his or her children anymore, certainly not to the degree required to enforce a few hours of abstinence from devices a day. And what good could a parent do when the schools themselves increasingly use laptops and iPads as instruments of learning? The small screens seem to have swallowed the world. The technological fix. The perpetrator was easy enough to locate, in Silicon Valley, or more generally, the high-tech industry that created the tempting devices and social networks that consume so much of our time. Silicon Valley is not just the source of the problem. It also seemed to be ground zero of the inattentiveness epidemic. A 2001 article in Wired sounded an early alarm. Diagnoses of autism and Asperger's syndrome were skyrocketing in Santa Clara County, home of Silicon Valley. Among the adult population of the valley, surely something was wrong with Steve Jobs, who alternated between obsessive attention to details and complete withdrawal into himself, between a spiritual aloofness and uncontrolled temper tantrums. Some observers thought they detected a hint of autism in the unblinking, almost affect-free Bill Gates, and the characters in HBO's Silicon Valley are portrayed as well within the spectrum. There is even a Silicon Valley syndrome, defined, incoherently, by the crowdsourced Urban Dictionary as a collection of personality traits and physical characteristics specific to individuals residing around the San Francisco Bay Area. The effects of SVS are often confused for autism or Helen Keller. Put that together with Apple's slogan, Think Different, and you might conclude that Silicon Valley has a problem not only with grammar, but with thinking itself. Rising concerns about shrinking attention spans should, if anyone had been paying attention, have created a sense of crisis in Silicon Valley. Suppose the company manufacturing a nutritional supplement advertised as miraculous was confronted with claims that its product actually enfeebles its users, which was roughly the situation the tech industry found itself in. Not only did Silicon Valley's corporate culture encourage a syndrome of inattentiveness and self-involvement, but its products seemed to spread the same derangement to everyone else. The devices that were supposed to make us smarter and more connected to other humans were actually messing with our minds, causing net brain and monkey mind, as well as physical disorders associated with long hours of sitting. As we click between Twitter and Facebook, text and hypertext, one link and another, synapses are being formed and then broken with febrile inconstancy, or so the neuroscientists warn us, leaving the neuronal scaffolding too fragile to house large thoughts. Hence the emergence of digital detox camps, where grown-ups pay to live without electronic devices, as well as alcohol, sex, and gluten, in order to reconnect with the real world. A less arrogant industry might have settled for warning labels on its phones and pads. Do not use while driving or attempting to hold a conversation, for example. But Silicon Valley has an arrogance problem, tech columnist Farhad Manju announced in the Wall Street Journal in 2013, in response to a tech titan's plea for greater independence from regulation. For Silicon Valley's own sake, the triumphalist tone needs to be kept in check. Everyone knows that Silicon Valley aims to take over the world, but if they want to succeed, the valley's inhabitants would be wise to at least pretend to be more humble in their approach. But humility was not in Silicon Valley's repertoire. Had they not, in just a couple of decades, transformed, or, to use their current favorite verb, disrupted, the worlds of entertainment, communications, business, shopping, dating, and just about everything else? In the process, at least 14 billionaires had emerged in the valley itself, which is certainly an undercount of tech billionaires nationwide. Wall Street and Hollywood could generate centimillionaires. Only in Silicon Valley could a young man, and it is almost always a man, without a college degree, rather suddenly acquire an eight-figure fortune. Silicon Valley, whether in the Bay Area, Austin, Cambridge, or New York's Silicon Alley, is a setting that breeds megalomania, or, as tech critic Evgeny Morozov terms it, solutionism, an intellectual pathology that recognizes problems as problems based on just one criterion, whether they are solvable with a nice and clean technological solution at our disposal. Anything is possible, any problem solvable, with a simple hack. Space travel? PayPal co-founder Elon Musk now heads up SpaceX, the first private space travel company. Health? Silicon Valley generates the personal monitoring devices that can continually reveal your inner workings far better than a doctor's office could. Who needs a doctor anyway? Picking up on the evidence-based critiques of medical practice, Vinod Khosla, one of Silicon Valley's most revered venture capitalists, publicly announced that healthcare is like witchcraft and just based on tradition, rather than being driven by data. Far better to pick up a little biochemistry and proceed to biohack your own body. Dave Asprey describes himself as a young, brand-new multimillionaire entrepreneur when he confronted his own obesity and attempted, unsuccessfully, to cure it by dieting and doing a 90-minute workout per day. Then he realized that our bodies and the Internet are not all that different. They are both complex systems with big pieces of data that are missing, misunderstood, or hidden. When I looked at my body that way, I realized that I could learn to hack my biology using the same techniques I use to hack computer systems and the Internet. Asprey's life-saving hack turned out to be bulletproof coffee. Expensive, mold-free coffee containing a generous portion of melted butter, which he now markets online and through his cafes. Exercise turned out to be just too time-consuming. For obsessive biohacking, no one tops Ray Kurzweil, the futurist, inventor, and best-selling author of a book on the coming singularity, when artificial intelligence will become self-improving and overtake the human mind. Like Asprey, Kurzweil sees the body as a machine, in fact, a computer, that can be continually upgraded. I have a personal program to combat each of the degenerative disease and aging processes, he writes. My view is that I am reprogramming my biochemistry in the same way I reprogram the computers in my life. The only exercise he undertakes is walking, and his nutritional routine would seem not to leave time for workouts and a gym. Every day he takes about 250 pills containing nutritional supplements, on top of which he spends a day a week at a clinic where supplements are delivered right into his bloodstream. Every few months, he relates, I test dozens of levels of nutrients, such as vitamins, minerals, and fats, hormones, and metabolic byproducts in my blood. The goal here is not something as mundane as health. Silicon Valley's towering hubris demands nothing less than immortality. The reason why Kurzweil has transformed himself into a walking chemistry lab is to prolong his life just long enough for the next set of biomedical breakthroughs to come along, say in 2040, after which we'll be able to load our bodies with millions of nanobots programmed to fight disease. One way or another, other tech titans aim to achieve the same thing. As Newsweek reports, Peter Thiel, the billionaire co-founder of PayPal, plans to live to be 120. Compared with some other tech billionaires, he doesn't seem particularly ambitious. Dmitry Itzkov, the godfather of the Russian internet, says his goal is to live to 10,000. Larry Ellison, co-founder of Oracle, finds the notion of accepting mortality incomprehensible. And Sergey Brin, co-founder of Google, hopes to someday cure death. There is, to say the least, a profound sense of entitlement here. Oracle's Larry Ellison is reportedly used to getting his way, and he doesn't see why that should ever stop. "Death makes me very angry," he has said, explaining why he has spent hundreds of millions to fund anti-aging research. If you are one of the richest men in the world, and presumably, since this is Silicon Valley, one of the smartest, why should you ever die? Controlling your mind. With immortality on the agenda, surely the little matter of mass inattentiveness had a solution, and I mean a solution in the solutionist sense, something convenient, marketable, and preferably available on existing devices. But the solution, when it made its way to Silicon Valley, came from a realm apparently unrelated to digital technology, and that is religion, in this case, Buddhism. Jon Kabat-Zinn, a Zen-trained psychologist in Cambridge, Massachusetts, had already extracted what he took as the secularized core of Buddhism and termed it mindfulness, which he extolled in two bestsellers in the late 1990s. I first heard the word in 1998 from a wealthy landlady in Berkeley, who advised me to be mindful of the suffocating Martha Stewart-ish decor of the apartment I was renting from her, which, of course, I was doing everything possible to unsee. The probable connection to Buddhism emerged when I had to turn to a tenants' rights group to collect my security deposit. "People like me, renters," she responded in an angry letter, "were oppressing Tibetans and disrespected the Dalai Lama." During the same stint in the Bay Area, I learned that rich locals liked to unwind at Buddhist monasteries in the hills where, for a few thousand dollars, they could spend a weekend doing manual labor for the monks. Buddhism, or some adaptation thereof, was becoming a class signifier, among Caucasians anyway, and nowhere was it more ostentatious than Silicon Valley, where star player Steve Jobs had been a Buddhist, or perhaps a Hindu. He seems not to have made a distinction, even before it was fashionable for CEOs to claim a spiritual life. Guided by an in-house Buddhist, Google started offering its Search Inside Yourself trainings, promoting attention and self-knowledge, in 2007. Mindfulness went public as a kind of movement only in the second decade of the 21st century, though, when Soren Gordhammer, a former teacher of meditation to at-risk youth and at one point an aide to Hollywood's chief Buddhist, Richard Gere, found himself broke, divorced, and in the grip of a terrible Twitter addiction. Something had to be done to counter the addiction to devices, and it had to be something that in no way threatened the billionaires who had lured us into it. As Mindful Magazine later pointed out, "The lords and leaders of high tech aren't about to dismiss new technology as the beginning of the end of humankind, not only because they don't want to work against their own economic interests, but because they believe in the innovative, interactive world fostered by new technologies. Yet they also know that technology can be distracting, not only from where we are in any given moment, but from where we ought to be going." In a stroke of genius, Gordhammer found a way to raise the issue while actually flattering the tech titans. He claims to have discovered that, while the rest of us struggle with intractable distraction, leaders from Google, LinkedIn, Twitter, and other major tech companies seem to be tapped into an inner dimension that guides their work. He called it wisdom, and started a series of annual conferences called Wisdom 2.0, based originally in San Francisco, in which corporate leaders, accompanied by celebrity gurus, could share the source of their remarkable serenity, which was soon known as mindfulness. At the same time, in London, a former Buddhist monk with a degree in circus arts, Andy Puddicombe, was trying to figure out how to spread Buddhist meditation techniques within the generally religion-averse business class. He and a partner created a company called Headspace, which at first staged events where large groups of people paid to participate in guided meditation sessions. When the customers demanded more convenient ways of packaging the experience, Headspace started marketing CDs, podcasts, and eventually a cell phone accessible app distributed by Apple and Android. Politically and monetarily, this was another stroke of genius. It catapulted Puddicombe from near destitution to a net worth of £25 million, while through efforts like Wisdom 2.0, simultaneously transforming the tech titans from being the villains in the inattentiveness epidemic to the putative saviors. There was an irony, Fast Company noted, in using technology to deliver mindfulness coaching to a population that's more and more tech-frazzled. Best-selling psychologist Daniel Goleman observed, more bluntly, "What a clever way to make money. Create a problem you can then solve." Mass-market mindfulness began to roll out of the Bay Area like a brand new app. Very much like an app, in fact, or a whole swarm of apps. There are over 500 mindfulness apps available, bearing names like Simply Being and Buddhify. Previous self-improvement trends were transmitted via books, inspirational speakers, and CDs. Mindfulness can be carried around on a smartphone. Most of these apps feature timed stretches of meditation, some as brief as 1 minute, accompanied by soothing voices, soporific music, and cloying images of forests and waterfalls. This is Buddhism sliced up, commodified, and drained of all reference to the transcendent. In case the connection to the tech industry is unclear, a Silicon Valley venture capitalist blurbed a seminal mindfulness manual by calling it the instruction manual that should come with our iPhones and Blackberries. You might think that the actual Buddha had devoted his time sitting under the Bodhi tree to product testing. The word enlightenment never arises in the mindfulness lexicon. Today, mindfulness, in its sleek and secular form, has spread far beyond Silicon Valley and its signature industry, becoming just another numbingly ubiquitous feature of the verbal landscape, as positive thinking once was. While an earlier, more arduous version of Buddhism attracted few celebrities other than Richard Gere, mindfulness boasts a host of prominent practitioners. Ariana Huffington, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Anderson Cooper among them. It debuted at Davos in 2013 to an overflow crowd, and Wisdom 2.0 conferences have taken place in New York and Dublin as well as San Francisco, with attendees often fanning out to become missionaries for the new mindset, starting their own coaching businesses, or designing their own apps. A recent Wisdom 2.0 event in San Francisco advertised speeches by corporate representatives of Starbucks and Eileen Fisher, as well as familiar faces from Google and Facebook. Aetna Health Insurance offers its 34,000 employees a 12-week program and dreams of expanding to include all its customers, who will presumably be made healthier by clearing their minds. Even General Mills, which dates back to the 19th century, has added meditation rooms to its buildings, finding that a 7-week course produces striking results. 83% of participants said they were taking time each day to optimize my personal productivity, up from 23% before the course. 82% said they now make time to eliminate tasks with limited productivity value, up from 32% before the course. It was Silicon Valley, though, that legitimized mindfulness for the rest of the business world. If mindfulness had first taken root in General Mills, it would never have gained the status it's acquired from Google and Facebook, Baking products just don't have the cachet of digital devices. Silicon Valley is, after all, the innovation center of the universe, according to its boosters, home of the best and the brightest, along with the new masters of the universe who replaced the old ones after the financial crash that temporarily humbled Wall Street. Mindfulness may have roots in an ancient religion, but the Valley's imprimatur established that it was rational, scientific, and forward-looking. To the tech industry, the great advantage of mindfulness is that it seemed to be based firmly on science. No hippie bullshit or other woo-woo was involved. Positive thinking had never gained much traction in Silicon Valley, possibly because the tech titans needed no help in believing that they could do, or hack, or disrupt, anything they set out to do. The other problem with positive thinking is that despite the efforts of PhD-level positive psychologists, it had no clear scientific backing, and in fact bore a strong resemblance to magical thinking. If I think it, it must be so. But advocates of mindfulness could always point to a 2004 study by a neuroscientist showing that Buddhist monks, with about 10,000 hours of meditation under their belts, had altered patterns of brain activity. Shorter bouts of meditation seem to work at least temporary changes in novices. The field of contemplative neuroscience was born, and Silicon Valley seized on it for a much-needed neural hack. Through meditation, monastic or app-guided, anyone could reach directly into their own moist brain tissue and re-sculpt it in a calmer, more attentive direction. Mindfulness, as its promoters put it, fosters, or, as it is often put, even induces, neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is an impressively scientific-sounding term, but it is an innate property of neuronal tissue, which persists whether we make a conscious effort to rewire our brains or not. Everything we experience subjectively, every thought and emotion, produces at least transient physiological changes in the brain. Trauma and addiction can lead to longer-lasting changes. Even fleeting events may leave the chemical traces in the brain that we experience as memory. In fact, plasticity is a pallid descriptor for the constant, ongoing transformation of brain tissue. Neurons reach out to each other through tiny membranous protrusions called spines, which can form or disappear within minutes or seconds. Spines appear to be involved in the formation of new synapses linking neurons, which in turn hold together the ever-changing structure of neural firing patterns. Synapses that fire frequently grow stronger, while the inactive ones wither. Well-connected neurons thrive while neglected ones die. There is even some evidence that neurons in mature animals can reproduce. What there is no evidence for, however, is any particularly salubrious effect of meditation, especially in BYTE-sized doses. This was established through a mammoth federally sponsored meta-analysis of existing studies, published in 2014, which found that meditation programs can help treat stress-related symptoms, but that they are no more effective in doing so than other interventions, such as muscle relaxation, medication, or psychotherapy. There is no excuse for ignoring this study, which achieved worldwide attention. So maybe meditation does have a calming, centering effect, but so does an hour of concentration on a math problem or a glass of wine with friends. I personally recommend a few hours a day with small children or babies, who can easily charm anyone into entering their alternative universe. As for Silicon Valley's unique contribution, Mindfulness app,